This special broadcast of the State of Alaska Judiciary is produced by 360 North in Juneau. I'm Rosemarie Alexander, KTOO News Director. In just a few moments, Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Walter Carpanetti will be speaking to a joint session of the Alaska House of Representatives and the Senate from the state capitol here in Juneau. Right now, legislators are coming into the House chambers, albeit quite slowly. The Senate President and House Speaker will soon gavel in the legislature for the joint session. The State of the Judiciary is the annual report to lawmakers about Alaska's court system. This is the third time Chief Justice Carpanetti has addressed the legislature since he took that office in 2009. It's also the 40th anniversary of the early speech, the first one given in 1972. Carpanetti of Juneau was appointed to the state's highest court in 1998 by then Governor Tony Knowles. Lawmakers are still slowly coming into the chambers. We see a number of empty seats, so we probably will be a few minutes delayed as the legislators move into House chambers, all 60 of them, the House and Senate together. It's interesting to note that all 50 judiciaries across the country have annual State of the Judiciary addresses to their joint legislatures. And as I said earlier, this is the 40th address for Alaska. The first one was done by Chief Justice George Boney in 1972. Again, lawmakers are standing around talking. They don't seem to be moving very fast, but we will have the address to the Alaska Legislature by Chief Justice Walter Carpanetti of the Alaska Supreme Court in just a few moments.
I turn the gavel over to the President of the Senate, the Honorable Gary Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This joint session will please come to order. The purpose of the joint session is to hear the State of the Judiciary address by the Honorable Walter Carpanetti, Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Representative Osterman.
Yeah, Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that all the roll call of the House be waived and all members be shown as present.
Thank you. Without objection, so ordered. Will Representative Thompson and Senator Pasterman please escort the Chief Justice to this joint session?
Chief Justice Walter Carpanetti is going to be escorted into the House chambers here in just a few moments. The House and Senate has gaveled into the joint session. And again, this will be the 40th anniversary of the annual State
Ladies
of the Judiciary Address.
The Chief Justice for the great state of Alaska, the Honorable Walter Carpanetti.
President Stevens, Speaker Chenault, Senators and Representatives, and guests, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the annual State of the Judiciary Address, and I'm honored and delighted to mark the occasion with what will be my third and last address to you as Chief Justice. In Alaska, I think we can be very proud of the spirit of collegiality and shared purpose that has marked the relationship between the judicial and legislative branches since my predecessor, Chief Justice George Boney, first stood before this body in 1972. In my view, and the view of many experts across the nation, our mutual efforts have yielded one of the finest and most accountable judiciaries in the nation. Before I begin my remarks, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues of the Supreme Court who are with us here today. First, our senior justice, Justice Dana Fabe, probably needs no introduction here. Justice Fabe has served on the court for 16 years following her appointment by Governor Tony Knowles, including two terms as Chief Justice. She chairs the Supreme Court's Fairness, Diversity, and Equality Committee and is statewide chair of Color of Justice, a law-related education program to encourage diverse youth to pursue legal and judicial careers. She's also the longtime chair of our court's of our Civil Rules Committee, Justice Fabe. Next, Justice Daniel Winfrey joined the court in January 2008 following his appointment by Governor Sarah Palin. He's a lifelong third-generation Alaskan from Fairbanks whose great-grandfather first came north over the Chilkoot Trail during the Klondike Gold Rush. Not that Justice Winfrey doesn't remind the rest of us chichacos during oral argument occasionally. He chairs our Access to Civil Justice Committee, which focuses on removing barriers to justice delivery, improving services to self-represented litigants, and expanding pro bono services across the state. In January, for example, he co-chaired the legal community's third annual Martin Luther King Service Day event, during which volunteers in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Sitka donated over $50,000 worth of services to help 372 Alaskans with their basic legal needs. Justice Winfrey. And finally, my colleague Justice Craig Stowers, who was appointed to the court in 2009 by Governor Sean Parnell after serving for several years as a Superior Court judge in Anchorage. Justice Stowers currently serves as chair of the court's Committee on Security and Emergency Preparedness. In just two short years, his keen intelligence, his tireless work ethic, and his strong sense of compassion and fairness have made an indelible mark on our court. Justice Stowers. Sadly for our state's judiciary, but happily for the Alaska's federal bench, our fifth colleague, Morgan Christen, left the Alaska Supreme Court last month to assume her new duties as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. We miss her already, I have to say, very much, but we console ourselves with the fact that she will continue to serve the people of Alaska in her new capacity, and we are confident that she will serve them with the same amazing dedication and care that we've been privileged to witness and which we admire. In the coming year, as we await the judicial selection process that will determine her replacement, former Chief Justice Warren Matthews and Senior Justice Robert Eastaw have agreed to help handle the load as justices pro tem. Next, I would like to introduce key members of the court's administrative staff. Christine Johnson has served as the court system's administrative director since 2009. Now, those of you quick with math will realize that it's 2012, and I said this was my third and last speech as chief, so I started in 2009 as well. And we took our current positions really within a few weeks of each other, and I confess to wondering back then if other people saw these concurrent changes as setting up some sort of perfect blind leading the blind situation. And I will confess further that I might have been one of those people. Well, 3 years later, I can tell you that despite my own administrative shortcomings, Christine's excellent management skills and many years of prior experience in court administration have kept us focused and on track as we have confronted a variety of challenges over these last 3 years. She continues her vital work as chair of the Criminal Justice Working Group's Efficiencies Committee, where her wealth of knowledge and boundless patience are much appreciated. I'd also like to introduce our new deputy director, Doug Wolliver, who's already probably well known to many of you. He served for 2 years as a legislative staffer before becoming an administrative attorney for the court system in 1995. Altogether, Doug has spent 18 consecutive legislative sessions in Juneau, away from his Anchorage family, working on behalf of the people of Alaska, and we are very grateful for his service. Doug brings extensive experience and expertise to his new position, which most of you know he assumed when longtime Deputy Director Chris Christensen stepped down last summer to join the legislative staff of the University of Alaska. We were all very sad to see Chris go, but very fortunate that Doug could step into the job so seamlessly. The final person from the court system is our new General Counsel, Nancy Mead, who is attending this event for the first time. Nancy is joining Doug in Juneau this session to help evaluate legislation affecting the court system. She served as court rules attorney for 7 years before assuming her current role last summer, and her fine writing and analytical skills, along with her familiarity with court rules and procedures, will be a great asset to all of us. So, Christine, Doug, and Nancy, thank you, and I'm happy to introduce you to the members of the legislature. I'd like now to introduce three people from the Judicial Council, which I think is one of the hardest working boards in the state of Alaska. Larry Cohn, the executive director who has guided the council through an unprecedented period of activity, is here. Also here is our newest member, a public member from Southeast, Ken Kreitzer of Juneau. And he's brought a valuable perspective to the council from his years of work in public safety and corrections, his service as the city councilman from Cold Bay, and his experience from having worked all over the state. I'd also like to recognize the presence of Chuck Kopp, who you may know as Senator Dyson's administrative assistant, but who I think of as a former member of the Judicial Council. Let me add a word about this council. I called it hardworking. Just this year alone, with the number of judicial vacancies appearing and the number of judges up for retention who must be assessed and about whom the council must recommend for or against retention to the voters, the council is scheduled to meet for the equivalent of slightly over a full month of working days. Add to that time the necessary time to travel to and from the meetings, the time needed to review the incredibly voluminous information about judicial candidates. Really, every candidate generates about 100 pages between the application, the writing sample, all of the study that goes into the candidate's background, checks, credit checks, police checks, we hope those come back negative, all sorts of things. There is a lot of work that the council just has to get through. Add to that the time to review the studies the council undertakes pursuant to its statutory obligations, and this volunteer position really starts to look like a second job. Frankly, the council meets regularly on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, just to be able to find the days when they can do it. I hope Alaskans can appreciate the work that the council does, and so it's my pleasure to introduce you to Larry Cohn, Ken Kreitzer, and Chuck Kopp, and I think they are back there. Thank you very much. Well, I'm addressing the members of the legislative branch, and I'm here on behalf of the judicial branch. And so as not to leave out the third, often called the first branch of government, I would like to introduce a member of the executive branch, my own favorite example and object of interbranch cooperation, Assistant Attorney General Annie Carpinetti. Thank you. Well, as you may remember, I addressed my first remarks to you in 2010 on the theme of interbranch cooperation, and I focused my second address last year on the theme of cost-effective justice. Both included overviews of the work of the Criminal Justice Working Group, which I continue to co-chair with our new Attorney General, Michael Garrity. Today, I'd like to continue this thread by addressing a topic that merges both prior themes and infuses much of the Working Group's current effort, the growing trend, both here and nationally, to slow rampaging prison growth and reduce spiraling recidivism rates and costs by applying concepts now known as smart justice. Smart justice means weighing, in every criminal case, the likely effectiveness of the actions that we take. Further, it means considering the costs of these actions to our resources, to public safety, and to the collective human potential of all of our citizens. In practice, it means making criminal justice decisions that reserve our most costly response to crime, prison time, for those cases where other less costly alternatives will not effectively protect the public or rehabilitate the perpetrator. We're all familiar with the high rates of criminal recidivism in our state, and we are all rightfully concerned. The problem is simple to define. Far too many Alaskan offenders, about 2 out of every 3 released, will return to jail within 3 years of their release. But addressing the problem successfully is probably the most complicated and daunting challenge facing our justice system. Slowing down the revolving doors of our courts and our jails would free up countless resources for other good purposes, both within the justice system and outside of it. And figuring out what works to inspire former offenders to lead law-abiding lives would give us a huge advantage in improving the health and safety of our communities. Yet with nearly 5,000 offenders in jails at any given time, and nearly 6,000 more on probation or parole, where do we target our limited resources to make sure that they make a difference? You may recall the problem I mentioned last year in this regard. How do we identify those inmates most amenable to rehabilitation? Well, more on this in a moment, but fortunately, 3 recent reports promise to help us find answers to these questions. And ladies and gentlemen, at this point, I want to interrupt my planned remarks to give you a heads up and to ask for your indulgence. The heads up is that these reports are dense. I can't get around that. I can't summarize them any more than I've tried to do here. The indulgence is this: I need to ask you to work hard for the next few minutes trying to follow the details of these reports that I'm about to give to you. If I don't do that, this speech is nothing more than, trust me, I read these reports and this is what they say. Okay. The first is the Alaska Prisoner Reentry Task Force, a committee of the Criminal Justice Working Group, which issued its 5-year Prisoner Reentry Strategic Plan 2011 to 2016. They did that about a year ago. This report is a very comprehensive vision that offers a number of hopeful recommendations for improving prisoners' odds for successful reentry after they finish jail time. These include expanded substance abuse treatment programs, expanded electronic monitoring, and improved responses to inmates' behavioral health needs. More about that later, too. Today, I'd like to mention 4 recommendations in particular because they bear directly on the role of the judicial branch. First, they said we should continue collaborative efforts to reduce recidivism across the 3 branches and among state and local agencies. They said collaboration best ensures that ideas and resources are brought to bear collectively on targeted problems. And we have seen the tremendous benefit of this approach in the work of MAGIC, which stands for the Multi-Agency Justice Integration Consortium, and in the work of the Criminal Justice Working Group itself, among others. So many important achievements in recent years, from the Electronic Discovery Project, which is now up and running in Juneau, which is designed to speed up criminal cases, to the electronic filing of minor offense citations in 18 courts now statewide, and we're adding more all the time, have come about because all concerned agencies came to the table and they worked together. In addition, we should continue existing efforts to track, identify, and share information about the factors that underlie our recidivism rates, without which it will be impossible to measure the success of our efforts. I couldn't agree more strongly with these recommendations because, as I've stressed before, we can achieve results by working together that none of us could dream to achieve working independently. Second, they said we should expand the PACE program, which ensures prompt court action and swift and certain consequences for probation violations. PACE, which is an acronym for Probation, Accountability, and Certain Enforcement, targets even relatively minor violations like missed appointments on probation or failed drug or alcohol tests, violations that the justice system rarely acted upon in a timely manner in the past. It was the habit to let them build up before something was done. In a recent Alaska Judicial Council evaluation, drug use by probationers in Anchorage dropped significantly after they began participating in the PACE pilot project. Pardon me. The majority, 68%, had no failed drug tests during the first 3 months of enrollment, and the failure rate overall dropped from 1 in 4 probationers prior to enrollment to less than 1 in 10 after enrollment. It takes a lot of working together of these agencies, and it takes a lot of resources up front, but it really looks like it's paying off. As hoped, the PACE model is helping keep probationers compliant and on the road to recovery, and we're looking to expand it to communities outside of Anchorage, which is the only place where it's working right now. Third, we should continue to improve our ability to collect and disseminate data across agency lines. Accurate facts and figures speak loudly to the problems before us and are an invaluable measure of where we are and where we need to be. Without current and accurate information about where our resources are going and what impact they're having, and without an efficient means to share this information, we're floundering in the dark. So again, we support this recommendation wholeheartedly. And finally, the recommendation is that we should place a greater focus on misdemeanor offenses, who account for a surprisingly high number of prisoners, over 25% at any given time, and as the task force suggests, examine existing, quote, laws, rules, and policies that lead to the incarceration of individuals who pose no substantial risk to the public safety, close quote. An expansion of therapeutic courts and other problem-solving courts for misdemeanor offenders is one recommendation for reducing incarceration rates for this population. Such courts address the problems at the root of criminal behavior, they have solid track records across the state, and they often succeed at reducing or eliminating prison terms. Expanding therapeutic courts for misdemeanor offenders would not only reserve prison beds and the prison budget for more serious felony offenders, but it might well ensure that misdemeanor offenders do not become more serious felony offenders themselves as a result of the prison experience. So that's the first report. A second new report, which was commissioned by the Criminal Justice Working Group, will be instrumental in our efforts to combat recidivism. It's the Alaska Judicial Council's Criminal Recidivism in Alaska 2008 to 2009. It provides a wealth of vital information and much food for thought. The report, which was released last November, traces current patterns of recidivism in the state by location, by type of crime, and by offender characteristics. We now know which prisoner populations are most likely to reoffend, the types of offenses most likely to be repeated, and where they are most concentrated. This is really invaluable information that serves not only as a baseline against which to measure future efforts to reduce recidivism, but also as a critical guide for targeting limited resources where they are most likely to be effective. I found a few of the study's results surprising, even counterintuitive, and I'd like to highlight them here today because they illustrate why we need concrete data to inform our decision making and to challenge our traditional ways of thinking about these issues. The first finding was that the more serious the original offense, the lower the recidivism rates. Over one-third of those convicted of misdemeanors commit a new offense within 1 year after returning to their communities, while just over one-quarter of felons reoffend within the same period. By 2 years, nearly half of the misdemeanor offenders are rearrested, compared to less than 40% of the felons. Contrary to what we might logically assume, the worst offenders aren't necessarily the most prolific. When we consider that over 25% of our prison beds are filled with misdemeanor offenders at any given time, these statistics make a compelling case for the Reentry Task Force's recommendation to focus more anti-recidivism resources on this population. Second, those convicted of driving under the influence, drug crimes, and sexual offenses, and I'll say here now, sexual offenses are grouped together, not broken down as to type, were among the least likely to recidivate. I was surprised by that. Given Alaska's high rates of alcohol and drug addiction and sexual abuse, this information seems promising to me because it indicates that these offenders may be more receptive than we might think to positive behavioral change. I know it can be dangerous to oversimplify this information, and I don't want to do that, but it provides a reason to think about focusing rehabilitative efforts in these areas. On the other hand, offenders convicted of violent crimes are among the most likely to reoffend and the most likely to recommit the same type of crime. It appears that we still have a long way to go towards addressing the violence that tears at the fabric of our community over and over again, often at the hands of the same people. Third, the Council's report confirms something that many of us have long suspected, namely that youthful offenders, males and minorities, Alaska Natives and African Americans, have among the highest recidivism rates. Taken together, these are sobering facts. Too many of Alaska's young men, particularly our young men of color, are spending their early adulthoods in our prison system. Their futures are being shaped not by the normative influences of their families or their homes or their communities, but by the rules and rituals of life behind bars. As the years go by, they will be less and less able to function as productive citizens, less and less likely to forge a healthy course for themselves and their families. Too often, this legacy passes to the next generation, where the tragic pattern continues. Finally, the Judicial Council's report identified Anchorage and Southeast as regions with the highest recidivism rates. Now, being a resident of Juneau who spends a lot of time in Anchorage, I found this at least worrisome. But it's hard to argue with the data, and we know now that the communities where our greatest challenges lie if we're to make a meaningful dent in recidivism with the limited resources at hand. In sum, the Judicial Council's recidivism report presents us with both a challenge and an opportunity. We have known our dismal recidivism numbers. Again, around two-thirds of prisoners reoffend within 3 years for some time. But now we know some of the details behind the numbers, and we have a greater ability to take informed and meaningful action. As daunting as this task may be, we must now find effective ways to intervene with those populations that hold the most promise of success. And we must consistently measure the steps we take against the baseline that has now been established. We've really never been better prepared to move forward together towards concrete, quantifiable goals. Against this backdrop of ongoing activity in Alaska, I'd like to introduce you to yet a third promising study by the National Center for State Courts entitled Using Offender Risk and Needs Assessment Information at Sentencing. I hope that a copy of this report has been provided to each of the members of the legislature. I'm not seeing them on desks, but we will get them to you if they're not there now. They are here? Great, thank you. Mine was green, that's why I didn't recognize it, sorry. According to this study, offender risk and needs assessments considered during the sentencing process have a marked impact on reducing recidivism. I'll give another brief warning. I think this is the toughest of the studies to get through. Last year, during my State of the Judiciary remarks, I mentioned that criminal justice experts divide offenders roughly into three categories of roughly equal size. Those who will almost always reoffend, those who will almost never reoffend, and those who could go either way. Devoting anti-recidivism resources to the first two categories is not cost-effective because they will likely make little difference in the ultimate outcome of that individual offender's case. Focusing resources on the third category, where a positive impact is most likely, is the smart justice approach. But the problem has always been in accurately identifying in advance the category into which a particular offender falls. Today, offender risk and needs assessments may provide a reliable method for making this determination. Three basic principles come into play. First, the risk principle holds that supervision and treatment levels should be determined by the offender's risk of reoffending according to a number of factors that study over time has shown are the most important factors. Second, the needs principle calls for targeting the provision of services to specific risk factors that, if left unaddressed, are most likely to contribute to a new offense. And third, the responsivity principle specifies that treatment interventions must employ, and I'm quoting here, cognitive social learning strategies, close quote, approaches designed to change behavior directed at an offender's specific risk factors. And what we are learning is that antisocial and pro-crime ways of thinking are the attributes most likely to lead to recidivism, and that effective treatment must specifically challenge those thought processes. Other treatments and interventions, such as substance abuse treatment and support for housing and employment, may help, but behavioral change is unlikely to occur without behavior-oriented therapies. According to the National Center for State Courts study, applying these three principles together, risk, needs, and responsivity, has been shown to reduce recidivism by 26%. Just imagine for a moment what a reduction in 26% in our recidivism rate, or even half of that, would do to improve criminal justice in our state. While corrections officials have used a variety of validated risk and needs assessment instruments for several years to determine appropriate levels of supervision and treatment for persons on probation or parole, the recommendation from the National Center to consider them at sentencing is relatively new. Just last year, the National Conference of Chief Justices, of which I'm a member, endorsed a resolution encouraging state and local courts to incorporate offender risk and needs assessments in the sentencing process. This recommendation, I think, is one of the most practical and promising approaches to date for putting offenders on track to successful reentry in a timely and effective way. It just makes sense that reducing recidivism should be considered at sentencing, that a sentencing decision should reflect a full understanding of an offender's risk of reoffending, and that sentence terms should include the level of supervision, behavioral therapy, treatment, or other services that are most likely to be effective against recidivism by this particular offender. Without this approach, sentence terms may not only fail to address the problem of recidivism, but may actually make the problem worse by imposing terms that are counterproductive. According to the NCSC report, and I'm quoting here, analysis of the effectiveness of sanctions such as electronic monitoring, boot camps, and incarceration that do not include behavioral intervention components show little or no reduction in recidivism. And in some cases, the sanctions have been found to actually increase it. Yet in Alaska, incorporating offender risk and needs assessments into the judicial sentencing process is not an easy proposition. Many assume, perhaps many in this room assume, that judges are able to carefully consider risk, rehabilitation, and a variety of other factors in shaping their sentencing decisions. And indeed, under our current law, judges are generally required to take an offender's prospects for rehabilitation into account. But the modern reality of the sentencing process is much different from the assumption. Under our state's presumptive sentencing laws, in place since 1978, the judge's role in sentencing is actually quite limited. The range of most sentences is prescribed by law according to the nature and seriousness of the crime, and can be modified only when aggravating or mitigating factors are proven. Because of this sentencing structure and the way it has been implemented and narrowed over time, judges today are rarely called upon to participate fully in the sentencing process. In the vast majority of cases, they simply approve or disapprove a plea agreement presented by the parties after negotiations in which the judges have no involvement and only the most superficial control. Prosecutors determine the initial charges. They may change the charges and make final offers on sentence terms, often after discussions with the defense, of course, and what discretion exists in the process rests largely with these players. While the judge technically has the authority to reject a plea agreement, a judge with a pattern of doing so would likely be preempted from future cases by one or both sides. Open sentencing, where the prosecution and defense have not agreed upon the ultimate sentence in advance, is quite rare, except in cases where no agreement is reached and the defendant is sentenced after going to trial and being found guilty, of course. But even in these cases, where no agreement is reached and the case goes to trial, which account for less than 5% of all of the convictions returned in this state, presumptive sentencing has narrowed the judge's rule so much that fashioning a sentence sometimes resembles following an elaborate cookbook more than anything else. It hasn't always been this way. When I was a young attorney trying cases in Juneau in the 1970s, sentencing proceedings, I thought, were pretty meaningful events where both sides presented in-depth information to the judge deliberated, and the decision was made by the judge. By the time I was appointed to the bench in 1981, presumptive sentencing was in place. I often felt more like an observer at sentencing, left to review and usually bless the work of the parties, but not really participating in the analysis and important decision-making myself. Today, in probably over 90% of our criminal cases, sentencings are largely ceremonial events where little information is truly debated. The details of a sentence, down to the terms of probation, are negotiated by the parties in advance and agreed to them, and the judge's role is really minimal. Now, presumptive sentencing was intended to restrict judicial discretion. According to the statute's commentary, it was enacted to eliminate unjustified disparities in sentencing among defendants convicted of similar crimes, disparities attributed to factors that included race and judicial sentencing attitudes that varied from strict on the one hand to lenient on the other. I'm not here to argue with the original intent of presumptive sentencing or the general policies behind it. Indeed, many states adopted similar models when Alaska did. And there are good reasons to seek similar accountability for similar crimes. The old adage of if you can do the crime, you can do the time is appealing on a gut level, and it has driven our criminal justice thinking for many years. It sounds tough, it rings true, and it seems only fair. But as we now know, the idea that jail time is the fitting response to every crime, or even to most crimes, has become an expensive and a possibly unnecessary proposition. Many of us have had the transformative experience of meeting and listening to Representative Jerry Madden of the Texas legislature. I know many of you in this room have heard him. He's come to Alaska on two different occasions and has spoken to many legislators. He's been a national leader in efforts to stem the growth of prison populations by implementing less costly and more effective programs for diversion, rehabilitation, and reentry. While Representative Madden identifies himself as a conservative Republican, the shift in thinking that he has championed finds wide support on both sides of the political aisle. And much has changed in the last 30 plus years in our understanding of criminal behavior. As one expert noted, and I'm quoting again, 30 years ago we knew very little about the causes of crime, we might more accurately now call them the risk factors, how to predict recidivism, or how to rehabilitate offenders. In fact, the state of our knowledge was so poor that it led one researcher to conclude that nothing works in reducing recidivism. Decidedly, this is no longer the case, close quote. Today, we have scientific corrections research that shows us what intervention strategies work best. These evidence-based practices could not have been considered when presumptive sentencing was adopted. The research hadn't been done at that time. And as a result, there's little room for them to be taken into account in the current sentencing structure. So while presumptive sentencing may have made sense over three decades ago, today it presents one of the greatest challenges to the implementation of new smart justice principles. So then, to summarize, a one-size-fits-all approach oversimplifies the challenge before us. As difficult as it may be to accept, we must ensure that sentencing decisions take the characteristics and circumstances of individual offenders into account, particularly their criminogenic risk factors. I tried to write the speech without using that, but I just couldn't. Not just the nature and seriousness of their crimes. We should require that the sentencing process weigh recidivism reduction in determining the sentence to be imposed. We must give judges and others involved in sentencing the tools to distinguish those who pose the greatest risk of recidivism from those who don't, and we must empower them to respond accordingly. And I hope you will consider the prospect of restoring the judge's proper role, proper according to me at least, in sentencing decisions. When we have a talented and an experienced judiciary that has been carefully selected to make the tough decisions that have to be made in our justice system, and when we know that effective sentencing requires a close fit between the sanctions imposed and an individual offender's risks and needs, it makes little sense to set narrow ranges in advance and leave all of the vital work of crafting appropriate sentences to others. Judges are a valuable resource, and they can and should play a strong role in implementing smart justice principles. I think if we're ever to turn the tide of prison recidivism, we must make room in the sentencing process for smart justice principles to take hold. Chief Justice Ray Price of the Missouri Supreme Court perhaps said it best in his own 2010 State of the Judiciary address to the Missouri legislature, and I quote, "There is a better way. We need to move from anger-based sentencing that ignores cost and effectiveness to evidence-based sentencing that focuses on results." Thank you for your attention to this section of these remarks. I promise no more studies. All three of these studies that I've highlighted today offer greater clarity and hope for addressing the challenges facing Alaska's criminal justice system, yet each one also underscores a perennial concern that I'd like to take a moment to mention. The special challenges to justice delivery posed by the isolation and cultural, social, and language differences of Alaska's remote villages. Among Alaska Natives, incarceration patterns are as disturbing as they are intransigent. Even though Alaska Natives comprise only about 18% of the state's general population, they make up 36% of Alaska's prison population. Not surprisingly, rehabilitative and reentry services that might stem high rates of Native incarceration are few and far between in many predominantly Native communities. So I've been quite pleased in recent years to follow a cooperative effort in the 4th Judicial District that promises to foster more successful criminal justice outcomes in villages across the interior. I'd like to take a minute to tell you about it. It's a unique effort to engage village residents more directly in the cases that affect them. A team of criminal justice officials has been traveling to villages along the Upper Yukon to hold circle sentencings with village residents in misdemeanor cases. At a circle sentencing, members of the community gather in a circle and one by one share the personal and community impacts of the offense, their concerns about the offender, and their views on what a fair resolution would be. While a judicial officer still imposes the final sentence, the decision is much more fully informed by local concerns and desires, and the offender is held accountable not only to the justice system, but to family, friends, neighbors, and the community. Circle sentencings have held such promise that Interior Justice officials have developed a new training manual that is near completion, and the approach is being considered even for more serious offenses. I think that the benefit of having the court system operate in a village goes far beyond the outcome of an individual case. Visits have helped foster mutual respect among the state, local, and tribal leaders involved in justice delivery, and they've helped build a greater community trust and confidence in the ability of our justice system to serve rural areas fairly and adequately. A judicial officer described the outcome of a circle sentencing in one village as follows, and I'm quoting here, "A lot more than a sentence recommendation was accomplished as a community that day, and thus far the defendant has remained out of trouble and is reported to be doing well." And he observed the following after a talking circle in another village, and I'm quoting him again. "There was another great community turnout and another priceless opportunity to talk and trade ideas. Of note to me was when the traditional chief asked the DA to close the circle in a blessing, an honor normally reserved for elders. This was a sign to me of the changes and positive aspects of our efforts to work together as a people." Close quote. In my view, these efforts really fall squarely under the Smart Justice banner because they seek to reduce extremely high incarceration rates here for Alaska's Native people through interventions that are more localized, culturally appropriate, and cost-effective. They also seek to marshal community resources in a coordinated way in a region where resources for rehabilitation and reentry are especially limited. By focusing so far on misdemeanors, they help fulfill the recommendations to devote more anti-recidivism resources to this offender group. And of course, they offer another fine example of the benefits of collaboration and a valuable reminder of how much more effective we are when we put aside differences to work together on common goals. I'd like to take just a moment to thank several people for their innovative work in this area. First, Magistrate Christopher McLean of Galena has spearheaded the effort. He's gotten great help from the prosecutors, Fairbanks District Attorney Michael Gray and Assistant DA William Spires, and from the defenders, Fairbanks Assistant Public Defender Steve Hansen and former Assistant PD Michael Biederman, Lisa Yeager and Michelle Gady of Tanana Chiefs Conference, and Galena Clerk of Court Pam Pitka have also been instrumental in this effort. I'd also like to thank our presiding judge there, Douglas Blankenship of the 4th Judicial District, his area court administrator Ron Woods, and rural court training assistant Oscar Calvillo for supporting these efforts, pardon me. And finally, Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Paul Lyle and Fairbanks District Court Judge Jane Kavar for their involvement in specific cases. I'd also like to extend special appreciation to the Alaska Native elders and traditional chiefs whose support has helped draw communities together for these important events. Clearly, it's going to take the best of our thinking, our creativity, and our cultural sensitivity to begin to reverse the historically high incarceration rates of Alaska Native people. And it will take listening, reflection, respect, and courage to better serve this population by confronting the occurrences of crime, working with village resources to bring offenders to justice, and then finding the ways to put communities back together. But this quiet work happening in the interior, it's been going on for a couple of years, along with other dedicated efforts in rural communities across our state, gives me hope that change in this direction is possible, and that the alarming statistic that has haunted us for so long, the dramatic overrepresentation of Alaska Natives in Alaska prisons, will soon be a relic of the past. I've devoted most of my remarks today to compelling developments in the criminal justice arena because I wanted to encourage your consideration of coordinated responses in a timely way. But before I close, I'd like to share news of other exciting developments in the court system that promise to significantly improve the way that we do business. While they don't technically fall under the Smart Justice banner because they have no impact on prison growth, there's no doubt in my mind that they are very smart steps to take towards efficient, cost-effective justice delivery. They're all on the civil side. First, now that we have implemented a computerized case management system, CourtView, at all 44 court locations statewide, we're embarking on the next technology challenge, probably a bigger one, developing and implementing a system for electronic filing of documents. Anchorage Superior Court Judge William Morse has agreed to direct this project. He and his steering committee will be faced with an enormous challenge in the coming years, and it will no doubt be a very long-term process. But the challenge is one that other courts, including the federal judiciary, have met with success, and one that I'm confident we can achieve capably and competently with your support. Second, I mentioned last year the Early Resolution Project, and I'm really delighted to report that it continues to show enormous success in helping self-represented family law litigants reach early settlement in their cases. It's for use only in cases in which both sides don't have a lawyer. It was founded in Anchorage by retired Superior Court Judge Stephanie Joannides and Stacey Mars of the Family Law Self-Help Center. It provides volunteer lawyers to help in family law cases, as I said, where both sides don't have a lawyer. Very soon after the cases are filed, these volunteer attorneys meet with the parties, they give them candid assessments of their strengths and weaknesses, and they help them settle their disputes. They help them navigate in the system, but mainly by giving them a good idea of the likely outcome of the case and trying to work with the other side in reaching a settlement. If a settlement can be reached, a judge is available that day to enter it on the record. I told you last year that this pilot program was really hopeful, and it was settling about 70% of the cases. Now the figure is an astounding 85% of cases, and given this amazing track record, the program is now expanding. It started just this month in Palmer. I heard yesterday that the first small session was an unqualified success, with five of the five cases settling, and we're hoping for a June rollout here in Juneau. We hope others can enjoy the benefit of resolving their family disputes early and fairly, with a fraction of the long-term conflict and expense that family cases often entail. Finally, I mentioned two other early resolution programs last year, and I promised you a fuller report this year. These programs are for potentially very difficult cases involving child custody disputes, and there's no limitation on representation. Often, the potential for early settlement is undermined by high conflict between parents and sharply different views about the likely outcome of a case. Emotions surely run high during these times, and it's easy to lose sight of the careful evaluation that a court must make in going towards the best interest of the child. So the first program is the Early Neutral Evaluation Project, designed to give the parties the benefit of an impartial assessment by an experienced child custody investigator who can help the parties focus on their children's needs and negotiate a positive way forward. In Fairbanks, Superior Court Judge Mike McDonald and the Custody Investigator's Office have led the way in developing this program, which diverts cases away from the litigation process and towards early settlement. The second program I mentioned briefly last year and promised to report on is the Judicial Settlement Conference Program, which offers parents the chance to weigh the relative strengths of their case with a retired pro tem judge who can provide a reality check to the parties, who can temper the hostilities, and who can explore mutually agreeable outcomes. Both of these approaches give the parties the benefit of professional and judicial expertise at the critical early stages of a custody dispute, before positions harden and unnecessary damage is done to the relationships of all concerned. I really think they're wonderful programs. Well, these developments in smart justice, primarily on the criminal side, but also with regard to delivery of justice services in rural Alaska, and in efforts to settle civil disputes earlier, are hugely encouraging to all of us who work in the field. On the criminal side, I hope that you will carefully consider these three new studies that I talked about, from the Prisoner Reentry Task Force of the Criminal Justice Working Group, the one from the Judicial Council, and the one from the National Center for State Courts. As you tackle the Herculean task of assuring that our criminal laws serve to protect Alaskans in a fair and a cost-effective manner. On the civil side, I hope that you will continue to support the initiatives designed to make our justice system work better. As you know, a new Chief Justice is elected by the court every 3 years, and my term will end on June 30th. In closing, I'd like to take this opportunity to say what a great honor it has been for me to get to know many of you and to work with you these past 2.5 years, and what a privilege it has been to continue this tradition on behalf of the Alaska court system. The goodwill that you have shown both to me and to the court system as a whole has really been tremendously gratifying, and I thank you for that. and the dedication that you have demonstrated to ensuring full and fair justice delivery across our state has been truly inspiring. As I've said many times before, you're probably tired of hearing me say it, interbranch cooperation, I think, is a key to ensuring the health and strength of our justice system. And I believe that our system is strong and healthy. The people of Alaska benefit most when we work together, and I'm really proud of everything we've been able to accomplish on their behalf. I believe I can speak for all of us in the court system, all 800 plus staff, clerks, magistrates, and judges across our state when I say thank you. Thank you very much.
This special broadcast of Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti's State of the Judiciary Address to the Alaska State Legislature has been produced by 360 North and KTOO News in Juneau. Thank you for joining us.
You're watching Public Television's 360 North, a great way to look at Alaska. Coverage of Alaska state government on Gavel, Alaska is made possible by viewers like you and these sponsors.
The community of Juneau, providing TV and internet access from Alaska's capital city to all Alaskans.
BP, helping to unlock Alaska's resource potential.
Support comes from AT&T. Visit us at att.com. AT&T, rethink possible.
Hayes Research Group, LLC, providing independent public opinion research solutions for Alaska.
By NEA Alaska, 13,000 teachers and support professionals working to create a bright future for Alaska's children and all Alaskans.
The Association of Alaska School Boards, fostering safe, connected schools as a foundation for academic...